Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Zoom. What's a Zoom room? It's what your conference room is meant to be. With flawless video and audio conferencing, instant wireless content sharing from any device, and just one tap of a button to start a meeting. Any space can easily become a modern, simple-to-use Zoom room. From tiny huddle rooms to executive offices to huge training rooms. And Zoom Rooms is effortlessly scalable, from a few rooms to a few thousand. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial of Zoom Rooms and meet happy with Zoom.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Mark Lobel, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 21st of December, these are our main stories. 3.5 years after Britain voted to leave the European Union, the House of Commons has decisively voted in favour of Boris Johnson's Brexit bill. The chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court says she wants to launch a full investigation into alleged war crimes in the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories. And the first mission of Boeing's new spacecraft has failed to reach the International Space Station. Also in this podcast... What exactly is happening at this festive season in the hallowed halls of some of England's most prestigious religious buildings? Three and a half years and two parliaments after Britain voted to leave the EU, MPs have endorsed a bill on Friday that could seal the UK's departure. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has called on the British public to now discard the labels of leave and remain. He insisted that Britain still wants a close relationship with the rest of Europe. Here's our assistant political editor, Norman Smith.
After 3 years of bitter parliamentary conflict and gridlock, MPs voted overwhelmingly in favour of the bill that takes Britain out of the EU.
The ayes to the right, 358. The noes to the left, 234.
A victory buttressed by a significant revolt among Labour MPs, with 6 voting for the bill and 32 abstaining, a result which puts Mr Johnson on course to leave the EU by the end of January. However, the Prime Minister chose to avoid any triumphalism and instead sought to reach out to former Remainers, urging all sides to come together to make a success of Brexit.
This bill... And this juncture in our national story, Mr. Speaker, must not be seen as a victory for one party over another or one faction over another. This is the time when we move on and discard the old labels of leave and remain.
Mr. Johnson said he believed Brexit could lead to a renewed sense of national self-confidence and free the UK to strike its own trade deals and to play a pioneering role in a fourth industrial revolution, a view flatly rejected by the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, who warned the Brexit bill would pave the way for more deregulation, a toxic trade deal with President Trump and the sell-off of the NHS. And Mr. Corbyn reaffirmed his party's opposition to the bill.
I say to all members, new and old, that it is our job in Parliament to question, to scrutinise and to hold the government to account day to day. If we believe the government is taking the wrong approach, we should never be afraid to oppose.
His stance, however, was challenged by a flurry of Tory Brexiteers who pointedly reminded the Labour leader of the result of the election. The deputy chairman of the European Research Group, Marc Francois.
He put his policy to the British people, in as much as anyone could discern it, in a general election. He was slaughtered. What bit of that message does he not understand?
A view that was echoed, albeit more in sorrow, by the Labour MP for South Shields, Emma Lewell Buck.
My party's catch-all Brexit policy failed. Today was and still is an opportunity to stop this procrastination, to send a message to our lost voters, the voters our party was created to give a voice to in Parliament, that we do hear them We do value them and we do genuinely want to rebuild their trust.
Unlike Labour, the SNP remain fiercely united in their opposition to Brexit, bolstered by their success in the election. The party's Westminster leader, Ian Blackford.
This legislation will hit our economy, cost thousands of jobs in Scotland, sell out our food and drink sector, and harm people's livelihoods. Yep. Mr Speaker, the Scottish National Party will not vote for this flawed and deeply damaging legislation.
Boris Johnson's hope that MPs might now unite behind Brexit is almost certainly wishful thinking. But with a divided and disorientated opposition and a commanding majority, it would seem he has little to fear from Parliament.
Norman Smith in Westminster there. The International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, says she believes alleged war crimes have been committed in the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories. Speaking in The Hague, she laid out her findings.
In brief, I am satisfied, one, that war crimes have been or are being committed in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. Two, that potential cases arising from the situation would be admissible. And three, that there are no substantial reasons to believe that an investigation would not serve the interests of justice.
She will now ask the court to confirm that it has jurisdiction over the areas in which she wants to conduct an investigation, the West Bank, East Jerusalem and Gaza. If it does proceed, charges may be filed against Israelis or Palestinians. Israel argues that the ICC has no jurisdiction in the territories, and its Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, says it was outrageous that claims made by the Palestinians hadn't been thrown out. Under the Rome Statute that established the court, it can hear cases only if one of the parties is a signatory. While Israel is not a party to the convention, the court accepted Palestinian membership in 2015. I asked our Middle East editor, Alan Johnston, what we can expect next.
The wheels of justice at the International Criminal Court move extraordinarily slowly, it seems. This all goes back to 2015 when the Palestinian Authority joined the ICC and the Palestinians made complaints about aspects of Israel's behaviour in the Palestinian territories. And at that point, Ms. Bensouda, the chief prosecutor, opened a preliminary probe, opening examination into the case. And now, 4 years on or more, finally Ms. Bensouda said today that she is satisfied that war crimes have indeed been committed. She didn't spell out exactly what they were, but she did release a note about a year ago in which she talked about Israel's military activity in Gaza, settlement building and other elements. She says, though, before she launches a full investigation, she wants the court to confirm that it does have jurisdiction over the East Jerusalem, the West Bank and Gaza, because the Israelis argue very vigorously that the ICC doesn't have that jurisdiction.
And if it was found that it did, where could this investigation leave Israel and other parties?
Where we are now is, given how slowly things move at the ICC, you won't see much happen for quite some time. Judges will go away and consider whether they do indeed have jurisdiction. During that time, you can expect Israel to make ever more vigorously its case that the case should have been thrown out, the Palestinian claims should have been dismissed. Prime Minister Netanyahu saying today it was an outrage that the case hadn't been thrown out and so on. The Palestinians will meanwhile hope, of course, that the court does decide that it does have the necessary jurisdiction. You can expect the Americans, the US, to weigh in alongside the Israelis in that diplomatic overtures towards the ICC. But if this was all to go to a conclusion where Ms. Bensouda was to open an investigation, and if she was to decide that charges could be pressed, then they wouldn't be pressed, say, against the State of Israel. They would be pressed against individuals who she regarded as possibly being guilty of war crimes, perhaps Israeli generals or officials. And it's just possible that they might be vulnerable to be arrested if they were to travel outside Israel to certain countries, but at the same time, important to say that Ms. Bensouda might conclude that the Palestinians, elements among the Palestinians, were also guilty of war crimes. They too might be charged, individuals among them.
Our Middle East editor, Alan Johnston. Let's stay in the region. Now, what do you do when the football club you've just bought has a terrible reputation for being racist? Beitar Jerusalem's hardcore fans would scream death to Arabs and use other discriminatory language during matches in Israel's top division. But when the high-tech business mogul Moshe Hogeg became the new owner, he decided to take them on, and his occasionally confrontational style is working. Our sports news correspondent Alex Capstick has been to Jerusalem to meet him.
Match night at the Teddy Stadium, home to Beitar Jerusalem, one of the biggest clubs in Israel, with historic ties to the right-wing Likud party. These fans, all decked out in the club's yellow and black colours, are making their way into the East Stand. It's where the hardcore ultras gather. They're known as La Familia, and many of them are wearing that name on their shirts. They're loud and passionate, but also with a reputation for being racist. Proud that their club is the only one in Israel's top division that has never signed an Arab player. Their behaviour was a big problem. Previous owners have tried to do something about it, but none has been as successful as Moshe Hogeg, the high-tech business mogul who bought Beitar last year.
Reputation was very, very bad. And I thought, you know, I can do good things in kicking out the things that doesn't add respect, not to the city and not to the country.
I mean, you've done that by being confrontational.
The way that I chose was to sue personally for damaging the reputation of the club. And I have zero tolerance for racism, absolutely zero. And my reactions towards racism is not proportional. It's not proportional. You shout one racist comment and I will sue you for $1 million.
And that uncompromising approach from the owner is working. There hasn't been a single racist incident inside this stadium all season. Sponsors, once put off by the club's bad reputation, are returning. Even performances on the pitch are improving. It's all good. Question is, will it last? This was a crucial moment for Moshe Hogeg. The goal scorer is Ali Mohammed. He's a Christian with a Muslim name. There were protests when he joined Beitar in August, but they quickly disappeared.
The biggest moment for me was that a player by the name of Ali Mohammed scores a goal wearing the Muhammad name on his shirt and all of the crowd cheering and calling his name. It's a big win.
A stone's throw from the stadium, children, Jewish and Arab, from West and East Jerusalem play a game of football. On their white T-shirts, the name of the project, written in Hebrew, Arabic and English, Team of Equals. It wasn't easy to get off the ground, but it's doing its bit to help bridge the divide in this complicated city. It's organised by Gal Karpel from Kick It Out. He also monitors all forms of discrimination in Israeli football.
Our job is to make everyone understand that there is a difference between what you can do outside and what you can do in the football stadium. Slowly but surely, everyone is moving in that direction in Israel, and especially Beitar. The atmosphere is very much changed in the past years.
The big test, though, will be if or when they sign an Israeli Arab player.
Yeah.
Do you think that will happen, and what do you think the reaction might be?
You know, it's one thing to convince them to stop chanting racist songs, but I'm sure that at least some of them will not like it. And I'm afraid to say there is a good chance Hogeg will lose that battle at the end.
There are some who say the current situation at Beitar is a temporary truce, which could disintegrate. But right now, Moshe Hogeg's reforms have proved popular, and any potential resistance won't stop him from signing an Arab player.
I don't care about his religion. I don't care about his color. I don't care. I care if he can help the team, if he's a good football player. It will never stop me from doing something that I believe in.
Moshe Hogeg, the owner of Beitar Jerusalem Football Club, ending that report by Alex Capstick.
Now, as we heard in the earlier podcast, a French court has found France Telecom, now known as Orange, and its former president guilty of moral harassment following a spate of suicides at the company in the late 2000s. Didier Lombard and two other executives were given four-month jail sentences. They say they'll appeal. The company was ordered to pay almost $4 million in fines and damages. As our correspondent Hugh Schofield reports from Paris, the case could have important repercussions for other businesses in France.
10 years ago, France Telecom was converting from a former state monopoly to a competitive market seeker in the new world of mobiles and the internet. At its HQ in Paris, they decided that the only way to survive was to be tough, and they got tough. With their own workforce. Staff had to adapt or go. Maintenance engineers found themselves manning call centres or sitting behind a desk with nothing to do. The shock was profound and drove many workers into depression or even suicide. Today, the court ruled that the company's strategy at the time amounted to a deliberate, sustained effort to destabilise staff in order to encourage them to leave. Raphaël Louvradou's father was one of the 19 people cited in the case who took their own life.
I, my mother, my brothers and sister are satisfied and relieved that the procedures used by management were illegal. That answers the question which goes to the core of what this trial is about. Can anyone do that in order to save cash, to push people to commit suicide or into depression? At least the court has said no, that's not possible. And if you do that, you'll be convicted.
The families are relieved, but French businesses will be examining the ruling to understand its implications. For the first time, harassment or bullying has been defined in law not as something inflicted in the workplace by an individual on an underling or a colleague, but as something inflicted by a company on its staff by virtue of its very policy. Some fear this will open the door for legal challenges in the future when companies seek to restructure and want to encourage people to go.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Facebook has announced it will stop using members' telephone numbers, which are given for security purposes, in its friends' recommendation system. The practice had been criticised by regulators and privacy campaigners. And in a separate incident, the company is also investigating a report that a quarter of a billion usernames and phone numbers have been leaked online. Here's our technology correspondent, Rory Kethlin-Jones.
Two-factor authentication is the method Facebook recommends to keep your account secure. It means every time you want to log in, you have to enter a code sent to your mobile phone, as well as your password. But last year, there was anger from privacy campaigners when it emerged that Facebook was also using these phone numbers to target advertising and to suggest friends to users. Now, after pressure from US regulators, the company is ending these practices. It's already stopped targeting adverts, and the friend recommendations based on the numbers will cease in the coming months. Facebook says it's also investigating a report that the names and phone numbers of more than 267 million users have been exposed online. A security researcher said the database, which did not contain passwords, had been available for download from an online hacker forum belonging to a crime group. It is now no longer online. Facebook said it was likely that the data was obtained before changes it had made in the past few years to better protect people's information.
Rory Kethlin-Jones. Now, something to look forward to on Christmas Day. Here's Jackie.
We've made a list. We've checked it twice. The year's best stories, inspiring and nice. The Happy Pod is coming to town. The sports stars and the doctors, the kind kids and the smart will celebrate their stories, their courage and their heart. So you won't want to pout, you'll smile and you'll cry. A bit, all good though. And if you listen out, perhaps by and by, the Happy Pod is coming. Well, if not to town, then at least to the Global News Pod feed. Anyway, it's out on December the 25th, and if you sent in your happy story, you might be in it too.
To India now, where at least six people have died in clashes in the north of the country as protests over a new citizenship law continue. Doctors in Uttar Pradesh state said post-mortem examinations would be conducted to establish the cause of death, though a local police chief denies his officers opened fire. More than 10 people have died across India since the new law was introduced last week. Since then, tens of thousands of people have protested against it. The authorities have responded with bans on large gatherings and by cutting off the internet in the worst affected areas, including the capital, Delhi. From there, Pratiksha Gildial reports.
It's been an extraordinary week in India. Massive protests have erupted across the country over a controversial new citizenship law that grants amnesty to illegal migrants from three neighboring countries, but only if they are not Muslims. People are enraged. Thousands took to the streets in the capital, Delhi, despite the freezing cold, denouncing the government and calling the law discriminatory.
What have we done? Modi doesn't want to talk about the economy or development. That's why he wants to divide Hindus and Muslims. We are not scared.
It was the same story in other major cities like Bangalore, Mumbai and Hyderabad. The issue has touched a chord with many Indians who see the law as an attempt by the ruling Hindu nationalist government to marginalize Muslims. Trouble had been brewing slowly since the bill was passed last week. But it all led to a major showdown at a top Delhi university over the weekend after the police allegedly roughed up protesting students after forcing their way into the campus. Students say the police used excessive force and beat many of them badly.
When they caught us,
Tanjeel Ahmed says the police hit him on his hands and he broke his arm.
We were begging for mercy. They broke our hands. They broke our head. They collected us in one place and they started abusing and hitting us again.
This incident enraged the entire student community across the country, with many coming out in support. What started as a student protest has now effectively built into a citizens' movement. But the government and the supporters of the law say that it will only help persecuted minorities from neighbouring Muslim-majority countries. That is Hindus, Jains, Buddhists, Parsis, Christians and Sikhs. Mukhtar Abbas Naqvi is the Minister for Minority Affairs.
The Muslims who have been staying in India for generations need not worry about losing their citizenship. There is no question mark over the status of India's minorities.
The government says it won't roll back the law. Many feel this could well be a defining moment for India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi's leadership, as people appear determined to continue the resistance.
Pratiksha Gildial in Delhi. The Queen's husband, the Duke of Edinburgh, has been taken to hospital in London for treatment for a pre-existing condition. Prince Philip had been staying at the Sandringham Estate in Norfolk in eastern England, where he and the Queen enjoy their traditional Christmas break. Buckingham Palace said the Duke had been admitted to the private King Edward VII Hospital in London as a precaution, as our royal correspondent Johnny Diamond reports.
Prince Philip is 98. In January this year, he walked away, shaken but pretty much uninjured, from a car accident that flipped his vehicle over on the road. But there have been a series of health challenges over the past few years. In 2011, he spent Christmas at Papworth Hospital in Cambridge, having a stent fitted to keep a coronary artery open. In 2012, he was twice admitted to hospital for a bladder infection. In 2013, he spent a couple of months recovering from an exploratory operation under general anaesthetic. But he returned to royal duties, only retiring from public life in 2017. The strong suggestion coming from the palace is that there is no immediate cause for concern. The Duke travelled to London by car rather than ambulance and walked into the hospital. The Queen remains at Sandringham. The palace describes the Duke's admission as a precautionary measure taken on the advice of his doctor.
Our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond. A test flight of a new American spacecraft, which is designed to carry astronauts, has failed to reach the right orbit. Officials at the US space agency NASA say there was a fault in a timing device. Luckily, no one was on board. Our science editor, David Shookman, has been monitoring the flight.
3, 2, 1, and lift off. The rise of Starliner and a new era in human spaceflight.
The launch, before dawn in Florida, went perfectly. The spacecraft, known as the Starliner, was built by the aerospace giant Boeing to carry astronauts. This was a test, before the first flight with a crew next year. But 30 minutes in, for reasons that still aren't clear, an automated timing system went wrong, and the spacecraft's rocket motors were fired in the wrong sequence. This left the Starliner in an orbit too low to reach its destination, the International Space Station. It's a blow to NASA. For the past 8 years, it's not had the means to get its astronauts into space, and it's hoping that companies like Boeing will provide the answer. The head of NASA, Jim Bridenstine, put a brave face on the failure.
Remember what we do as an agency. We do really difficult things, and we do it all the time. And yes, we have challenges, but what do? We figure out what those challenges are, we fix them, and we move forward.
The plan now is to land the Starliner in the New Mexico desert on Sunday, and then sort out the timer before risking a launch with people on board. As US officials and engineers digest what went wrong, they'll be all too aware that many other countries have ambitions in space.
David Shukman. And one of those countries who has ambitions in space is Ethiopia. The sound of Ethiopia's first satellite being launched aboard a Chinese rocket, which was broadcast on state TV in Ethiopia. Tim Frank spoke to Beza Tesfaye from the Ethiopia Space Science Society.
It was very exciting. So I didn't even get enough sleep yesterday, because I had to plan my way to the place, and of course the excitement, and then chatting with families and friends.
And what's the purpose of the satellite?
Well, it is a remote sensing satellite, so it's basically is expected to get different measurement of the country's weather that could serve for agriculture and different outputs.
And is this going to provide the sort of information, more accurate information, which is going to mean that you will be able to plan things like where crops are planted and when they're reaped and those sorts of things, when they're harvested, in more detail and more accurately?
Well, we're hoping to get more measurement of the weather conditions, the moisture and such. And then we're hoping to get it more in an accurate way, because the remote sensing satellite will be focused only to Ethiopia.
Right. And presumably this is important with the climate changing in Ethiopia and the massive effect that's having on a large proportion of your population.
Absolutely.
Ethiopia's economy, of course, it's been growing very fast for the last several years, but it's still a very poor place, and a lot of people may wonder whether this is money well spent, given that a lot of people in Ethiopia struggle even to have basic services.
Yes, this is exactly why we're doing this, because space technology and application in these days are the major supporting technologies that can yield a better production and the national developmental goals, such as agriculture and different aspects of the government developmental areas.
And how much is this satellite costing?
The satellite cost about $8 million, which we got as an aid from the Chinese government. And it also cost additional $2 million for the ground control center that was built in Addis Ababa at the Indoto Observatory and Research Center.
Beza Tesfaye from the Ethiopia Space Science Society, who is speaking to Tim Franks. There has been a less than silent revolution in the hallowed halls of some of England's most prestigious religious buildings. A tradition that's been the case for over 1,000 years has now been shattered. To reveal what's happened, here's Valerie Sanderson. Now listen very carefully.
It's an evocative sound that heralds the start of Christmas. But can't you tell the difference between that soaring sound and this? Well, the first piece of music was sung by a boy chorister and the second by girls. And for the first time ever, girls now outnumber boys in England's cathedral choirs. Salisbury Cathedral set the trend when it first admitted girl choristers back in 1991. Others have followed, including Wells, Liverpool, Ely and Gloucester. Some choirs are mixed, some alternate between the sexes. Boys are accepted between the ages of 8 and 13, when their voices usually start to break.
For girls, of course, that isn't a problem, and they can join right up to the age of 18. Of the 42 Anglican cathedrals in England, only three now remain boy-only, which is seen as a problem by some, according to Madeline Davis from the Church Times.
I know that sort of one of the musical directors was arguing today that boy choirs are important and that we don't want to see a situation where they're discouraged or there are fewer boys singing in choirs as those sort of numbers change.
But others are enthusiastic, arguing that instead of replacing a tradition that started with monks, it's creating a new kind of choral experience and it's giving girls opportunities once only offered to boys. Here's Madeline Davis again.
Some people feel that it kind of shares out the burden, so there's a huge amount of work involved in being involved in a choir, and if you have girls as well, there's kind of a sharing out of that duty to sing and there's sort of more opportunity for people to be involved.
Indeed, research has shown that if male and female choristers are singing the same material with the same acoustics and have had the same training, people listening simply can't tell the difference.
Our very own angelic chorister, Valerie Sanderson. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Mark Lobel. Until next time, goodbye.
When you're not opening presents this holiday season, try smashing your way through some tricky chocolate-coated levels on Candy Crush Saga. In between dinner and dessert, switch and match. During one of Uncle Mike's long stories, master the candy. There are thousands of levels to play in the all-time favorite classic Match 3 game. Get that sweet feeling this holiday with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.